House Civil Law Committee will come to order. Chair recognizes a quorum. Can I have a motion on the minutes?
So moved.
Minutes have been moved. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Members, first item of business we will take up is subcommittee reports from the Data Praxis Committee. Members, I'd note that there will be an omnibus bill, and this will be the corpus of the omnibus data practices bill. However, these bills today we are sending out individually as they have to pass other committees. There is a packet in your folders containing a copy of each of these bills. They were given a full hearing in the data practices subcommittee, so there will be no testimony or discussion on these, but we will vote on the adoption of the subcommittee report and give the author a chance to speak briefly, including any changes made in the subcommittee. So we'll start with House File 501, and Representative Simon, can you speak to that?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think, should I just make the motion here that I'll move adoption of the subcommittee report with respect to House File 501?
Yes, thank you. That it be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register.
That too.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Simon.
One second,
Representative Simon. There we go. We have to move adoption of the subcommittee report. And vote on that. And then move adoption of the bill and vote on it. So before discussion, I'll move adoption of the subcommittee report. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed say no.
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 Motion passes. Then Representative Simon moves adoption or moves the bill, House File 501, that it be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. Representative Simon?
Thank you. I'm sure Representative Hellstrom will be here, but until she's there, basically what this bill does, as I understand it or as I remember it, it just permits medical examiners and coroners to use identification card photographs. Right now, the statute classifies driver's license photographs and state ID card photos as private data, and they can only be used for certain purposes. This would just say that it would allow the use of these photographs by county medical examiners and coroners for investigation and identification purposes. It was not controversial. Someone can correct me if I'm wrong, but in the data practice subcommittee, this was not among the controversial bills.
Okay. Thank you. Then, what's that? Then Representative Simon has moved that House File 604, 501, be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Then Representative Simon, House File 604.
I'll move adoption of the subcommittee report on House File 604.
All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Then Representative Simon moves that House File 604 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Education Policy. Now, Representative Myra is here. We're just doing this really briefly, Representative Myra, so there you're there if there are questions on it.
Sure.
Okay, thank you. Why don't you just briefly explain it, Representative Myra?
This was a bill that was passed unanimously last year and signed by the governor. However, in the interim, we found some loopholes and some problems. Taxpayers, parents, and advocates for transparency came to me and asked me to bring it forward again to clarify and tighten the law. We have done that. After the amendments that were passed in Data Practices Subcommittee on Friday, the concerns of a number of organizations have been addressed. Those include the Association of Minnesota Counties, League of Minnesota Cities, Minnesota School Board Association, Metro Inner County Association, the Minnesota Elementary School Principals Association, the Minnesota Association of Secondary School Principals, the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, and the Minnesota Newspapers Association. The way my bill was in the first place, it was all that I wanted. I'm getting less, but I'm still content. Thank you so much for hearing this bill.
Thank you, Representative Myra. The motion has been made. The House File 604 be recommended to pass and re-referred to Committee on Education Policy. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. House File 621, Representative Simon moves the adoption of the subcommittee report. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Representative Simon moves that House File 621 be recommended pass and be referred to the General Register. Representative Simon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the absence of Representative Winkler, this bill, again, was not a controversial bill, but Representative Holberg, Scott, Portman, and Winkler can correct me if they think I'm mischaracterizing. This bill just classifies data maintained by the Department of Administration that identifies an individual with a disability or family member as private data. That's it. That's the bill.
Okay. Thank you. The motion is that House File 621 be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. House File 798, Representative Simon moves adoption of the subcommittee report on House File 798. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes. Representative Simon moves House File 798 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Transportation Policy. Representative Simon?
Well, I can't say the same about this bill. There was some lively discussion about this bill. I don't think Representative Earhart's here. I just want to put an exclamation point, Mr. Chair, on what you said earlier. The time for extended and expanded debate on this will be when we do the omnibus bill amendments, discussions, testimony. The reason we're doing this today, as I understand, Mr. Chair, is some of these have to make independent deadlines, and we don't want the whole omnibus bill to have to move from committee to committee. So, but that said, what the bill does is it's a Department of Transportation bill, and it says that the following data related to the Minnesota Road Use Pilot Project is non-public or private data. First, names, contact information, application information, vehicle information, road usage data, and financial and credit data of participants. And next, application information for the GPS navigation device. So the department here would be able to provide summary data of this information and could share the data with federal, state, or local law enforcement agencies acting pursuant to a valid probable cause search warrant. The department also wants to classify data related to construction managers and general contractor contract information, and the bill proposes different classifications of the data at different times during the contracting process, with the most of the information becoming public at the end of the process. I know that's a mouthful. What makes it controversial to some is just the whole idea of this pilot project and whether or not there ought to be more details considered in terms of how this data is handled. So I'll concede that there was a vigorous debate on this, but
thank you.
It sounds like this isn't the time.
Has moved that House File 798 be recommended pass and be referred to Transportation Policy. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes. I move, Representative Simon moves adoption of the subcommittee report on House File 828. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. Members, this is the technical bill. I move that House File 828 be recommended to pass and re-referred to public safety. Ms. Engler is here. If Ms. Engler, can you just speak really briefly on it? Members, this is the technical bill with a number of provisions, which I don't recall as being controversial. But Ms. Engler, if you can speak to it briefly.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Katie Engler from the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. House File 828 was heard in subcommittee last week. What you have before you is the Delete Everything Amendment. These all relate to our secure communications network. What we're doing is doing cleanup, getting things into a more current language for the type of technology that is used today. And we're also specifically directing how certain background checks are done for things like explosives licenses and permits, liquor licenses, and local checks using the Minnesota Criminal History Repository. And with that, I'll stand for any questions.
Ms. Engler? I move that House File 828 be recommended to pass and re-referred to public safety. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. Representative Simon moves the adoption of the subcommittee report on House File 589. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no.
Motion
passes. Representative Simon, can you speak to House File 589?
Sure. I don't see Representative Kahn, so I'll fill in. This is the bill. Actually, it's a somewhat rare Kahn-Holberg collaboration on data issues. It sounds like there was relative peace reached, and it's a Department of Health bill, and it clarifies genetic privacy issues for the department, and it basically is an outgrowth of the Bearder decision by the Minnesota Supreme Court. It placed restrictions on blood samples collected under the Newborn Screening Act. It basically... House File 589 provides express statutory authority, express authority, which is important, to MDH to collect, store, use, and disseminate biological specimens and health data in order to continue operating its health programs. And then the aim is to maintain individual genetic privacy. That's it in a nutshell. Representative Holberg might be able to elaborate more on the bill, but we did get, I think, some measure of peace in the committee.
Did you want to say anything on this, Representative Holberg?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Kahn and I have had a brief conversation. I don't see her today. I think there's some opportunities to make this a little bit better, but we'll work on it as it moves through.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Holberg. The motion on this, members, is that House File 589 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, say no. Motion passes. House File 804, Representative Simon moves adoption of the subcommittee report on House File 804. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. This is Representative Scott's bill. So Representative Scott moves that House File 804 be recommended to pass and be referred to public safety. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Currently, the Department of Corrections has the authority to collect employment data on felons that are incarcerated, but they don't have the same ability or the same authorization to collect data on people that are felons that are on probation. And so this would just allow them to get that employment data so that they can see if their training and rehab efforts are working.
Representative Scott moves that House File 804 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Members, we have one last bill in the subcommittee report. Representative Simon moves the subcommittee report on House File... Okay. On House File 782, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes. Representative Simon moves that House File 782 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. It's Representative Norton's bill. Representative Norton, did you want to speak to this briefly?
Morning, Mr. Chair.
Morning, Representative Norton.
Thank you very much for hearing 782, and I appreciate you passing it along. It simply extends the Newborn Hearing Screening Advisory Council, and this committee is more interested in the data collection. We want to retain the data from the newborn hearing screenings. It has nothing to do with blood spots. It's simply the information from the hearing test. If we destroy this information, we actually ruin the integrity of the process that's currently in place, as children often that are found negative at the beginning when they're continued to be followed over the years and have retesting, they're often found to have a hearing loss. And if we destroy this data immediately, the opportunity to encourage parents to go back for these tests could be jeopardized, and then the children aren't caught soon enough. And with children with hearing loss, the sooner you're caught, the faster services can be provided and the better outcomes you have in education and future earnings. So we hope that the committee will approve this. We don't want to be the only state in the country that destroys this information. Minnesota's always prided itself in excellent collection of data and usage of that data. So we're asking for you to pass this bill, and we will continue working with Representative Holberg and the department to make certain that the language is such that we're not doing anything for changing the opt-in, opt-out provisions of law as it currently stands.
Thank you, Representative Norton. I move that House File 782 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Norton.
Thank you very much.
What's that? Okay, members, now we are on to bills. The first one up will be House File 838, Representative Schoen. Court Services Detention and Corrections Data Access Provided for Domestic Fatality Review Teams. I will move the House File 838 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Policy. Representative Schoen, to your bill.
Morning, Mr. Chair, and thank you. I have before you just a quick addition to a team that's already in place. The Domestic Fatality Review Team is already in place, and they already collect data on a lot of high-profile incidents that we have around the state, including what we've had in Cottage Grove Today I brought with Sergeant Randy McAllister, one of my coworkers down in Cottage Grove, and who's a lethality assessment professional as well. But what we did with this is just included court services data under Section 13.84, which is on line 1.17, and then at 1.24, or 1.23, we're added, the review team has access to corrections and detention data as provided in Section 13.85. The reason we did this was just to clarify some issues between Department of Corrections and the Domestic Fatality Review Team. And we've talked to Department of Corrections as well, and they're comfortable with us adding this language to make sure that they're not violating any issue. Initially, the review team was working with Corrections and was having some difficulty getting the data for these issues, and this fixes that and makes everybody a little bit more comfortable. And if you have any questions about what the Fatality Review Team does or what this may help with, Randy's here to help us out.
Thank you very much. And Sergeant McAllister, you'll stand by for questions if we have them.
Sure.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions from members of the committee? Representative Holberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't have any problem with the correction and detention data. When this review team was set up, it was not without some controversy. And as I look at what's included under 13.84, this group would be able to get very sensitive data about family members. I mean, we're going far beyond just the victim and the perpetrator, and I have some real concerns about that. I think that, I mean, there's a lot of information that you already have access to, and I'm just, and I'd like to hear more about why you should have access to things like court orders about treatment, divorce, public benefits, child abuse, third-party information from psychologists, probation officers, respondents to family court. I mean, you're basically at this point not just concentrating on those directly involved, but really opening up to all the family secrets. And I know why you want that. I understand that. But at some point, we have to say, you know what, that's probably a little too much information for these purposes.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I certainly understand that your concern on that issue, and I understand the concerns from the other side as well, too. And I think I'm going to let Sergeant McAllister just answer, discuss it just a touch and say why this might be that vitally important in the future.
Before you do, Sergeant McAllister, can I see a show of hands if there are members of the public that wish to be heard on this bill? Okay, thank you. Sergeant McAllister, go ahead.
Thank you, and I appreciate those concerns. As you may or may not know, the Domestic Fatality Review Board was set up. Their whole purpose is to study domestic homicides, and in order to identify the circumstances around those homicides, and really to push for some systems change so we can prevent these in the future. We've seen plenty of evidence of the need for this in the news recently with St. Paul, some high-profile cases. In the world of threat assessment, it's vitally important to get that collateral information from other people surrounding the perpetrators. Usually in the world of threat assessment, we're trying to prevent the homicide. So we're going out and speaking with friends and family, trying to identify those risk factors. Certainly, you had mentioned, I think some job issues, treatment issues. All of those are risk factors for targeted violence. Certainly chemical issues are. In the world of domestic fatalities, chemical and drug use is a big risk factor. So that is the purpose or the reason that the Fatality Review Board would like access this information. And I'm not a part of the review board, but I'm working on sort of a parallel project here in the next coming year, and I've been in conversations with them, and this is one of the sort of the blind spots they have when they're trying to look into the situation, into the homicide, and identify what could we have changed, how could the system respond differently to prevent this.
Representative Holbert.
Mr. Chair, let me just, under subdivision 3 of this, we have third-party information, and it talks about gathering private data from a psychologist, probation officer, when they're ordered to get information on defendants, parolees, probationers, petitioners in family court. It says that you can get that information on the condition of it being held confidential. That data and the identity of the source shall be confidential data on individuals. And so we have already recognized within this section of law that there's some pretty sensitive stuff going into this process and have given a higher definition of confidentiality because of that. And now that is being asked to be disclosed to this review board. Another area, child abuse data, it may or may not even relate to the particular relationship between the victim and the person that committed the crime. There could be a completely, you know, they're having nothing to do. It could be involve an individual that maybe was a relative of the victim and in no way ever had any contact whatsoever with the perpetrator. And I'm very concerned that this is so broad that will undo very important protections that we put on very sensitive information held by the courts. And I mean, at this point, I understand what you're trying to do, but I think you're going way too far in your authority and your access to information that we as public policy makers have recognized as being very sensitive.
Thank you, Representative Holbert. Other questions from members of the committee? And seeing none. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the witness mentioned threat assessment. And I don't know much about this review team, but in what sense is there a threat? I understood this was somebody who's already deceased. Now, I guess the person who's the perpetrator could be threatening other people, but, I mean, where is there a threat assessment in this?
Well, the whole
Sergeant McAllister.
I'm sorry. The whole purpose of the legislation initially was to study these cases and see if there was a threat, you know, a threatening behavior or red flag type behavior that could have been identified prior to the homicide, and then actions could have been taken within the system, whether it's criminal justice, you know, law enforcement, probation, courts, whatever, advocacy services, and have prevented it. So it's sort of a threat assessment after the fact. It's really going back and looking at what could we have done better to protect this victim and keep her alive. And so in that respect, you're sort of doing a threat assessment just in reverse, and that was the whole purpose of this creation of this review board.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Schoen.
And Representative Liebling, one of the things that's come out of this, just a piece, is now that they've been able to study this for a while, we're doing something called a threat assessment at the team, a lethality assessment. So when Randy and I go out to a house and deal with a domestic incident, where it's an assault and no one's dead yet, we can go through this list of questionnaires. It's a simple list of questionnaires, and I ask you a bunch of questions, and I can score you in and say, hey, this person has a high probability to kill you. You're going to end up dead. And in the instance in Cottage Grove, our officers did that, and that's exactly what happened. He killed her later on. Now, the only nice thing that we had there was so that at least we could come to her and say, we have scientific data that shows that this is a high probability. It's not just that Dan and Randy, after 11 and 15 years on the job, have a good idea, and we got that sixth sense about this. This is, we're showing you. And that's what we're trying to do. I mean, we're certainly not trying to expose data and leak it, because this team has been given some pretty big leeway in the world of private data to collect, review, and not share, other than just saying these are the types of things that come up. Not about individual cases, but it lets them know that under these circumstances, this is the type of thing that might happen. And the more data we get, the better.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Schoen. I think we all agree how important this is. There's no question about that. And to the degree that this has been research that's been done and what you're describing, it's incredibly important work. There's no question about it. But I'm just kind of focusing on what we're talking about today in terms of the bill. and what kind of data it would bring in. And I'm kind of sharing Representative Holbrook's concern that maybe we need to tighten this up a little bit and just be cognizant. And I'd sure like, I don't have the statute in front of me like she does, but before she started reading it, I was going to ask staff to give us a copy of it or, you know, tell us exactly what's in here, because I'm just thinking that it might, I mean, certainly data that's really necessary to make improvements. I think what you're talking about is really research that helps into this whole area of domestic mm-hmm. abuse, which I'm all for research. I'm a big believer in that, and it's like evidence-based policing is kind of what it is, right, which is wonderful. But I'm also concerned that you might be under this, just citing this section, you might be bringing in data that really maybe shouldn't be, and I just don't know if I think maybe there needs to be more of a showing that some of this is really related.
So, Representative Lieberman, you're looking for a copy of a statute then?
Yeah.
Okay, if staff could get that to her offline, that'd be helpful. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just this is a question, I guess, of Representative Holberg, and the section, sorry, that you're reading out of Representative Holberg, was that pertaining to court services data, or was that pertaining to corrections and detention data?
Oh.
So 3.84, 3.85.
Representative Holberg.
The 3.84.
Representative Scott.
I mean, 13.84.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm wondering if the court services data, which is the section that Representative Holberg read from, if that section just could be stricken from, you know, in the form of an amendment, just delete that as something that they could obtain.
Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I certainly would support that, but I guess what I need to hear from the bill author, if you read the paragraph where that citation sits, we previously carved out medical records of the victim. I mean, there's, when you look at what surrounds that in information, there's a lot of information that you have access to relative to the victim, the perpetrator, other victims of the perpetrator. So tell me what you get in 13.84 that you're not already getting, given all the other language in this statute.
Representative Sean.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and it touches on probably what Representative Liebling was talking about, and that's research. And this isn't about prosecution. I mean, the person's already convicted. They're in prison. And quite frankly, knowing about their childhood, knowing about a lot of that background, really does give us a scientific basis to educate our victims and educate our police officers, educate our judicial system, judiciary when they're doing sentencing, etc. Because sometimes now when we come in with this information, we have judges that are now recognizing that this is scientific and we can get a bail that's significantly higher for monitoring, you know, GPS monitoring. Ramsey County started that program, and these are extremely valuable tools to help us save folks. And again, I absolutely recognize your concern.
Representative Holbert.
Well, Mr. Chair, I didn't really hear an answer to my question. When you look at the current law and the broad access and latitude you already have to medical records, et cetera, what can't you get your hands on now that if we give access under 13.84 that you would get? What can't you get now?
Well, Sergeant McAllister.
Just a clarification. I believe the Fatality Review Board's not looking, you know, if the guy gets arrested for this instant crime of homicide, they're not looking for records now that he's in prison. They're looking for stuff before the homicide was committed to see if there's anything in the prison records that could have predicted this. That's from my conversations with them. They're looking for things, you know, like prison discipline issues. They're looking for statements that he have made, may have made that were documented. They're looking, in some cases, they're looking for visitors so they could do some collateral interviews and see if those anything was shared with those visitors. So,
Mr. Holbert, those examples, I think, are given to you under the area of the bill that I don't really care about. I'm asking you specifically, what data sets do you not have access to currently that you think you're going to get under 13.84, and why are they important?
Sergeant McAllister. Well, you're.
I don't see any.
Sorry, McAllister.
Sorry, I don't see any reference under subdivision 4 A or B to in the existing statute for access to any of those Department of Corrections records.
Representative Holberg.
Mr. Chair, again, I don't care about the corrections and detention data. I don't care about that. I think you now have a copy of 13.84 in front of you. You also have a copy of current law in front of you. Can you tell me, I mean, current law is pretty broad in what we're giving you on access to information about both the victim and the perpetrator. My concern is the unintended consequences and other people's records that are mixed in with the victim and the perpetrator under 13.84. And so I'm trying to get from you what you're not getting your hands on now. Has this group sat around a table and say, gee, we could really do a much better job if we got third-party information under 13.84? Or, I mean, you already get medical information, public health stuff, domestic abuse stuff, medical records, inactive law enforcement investigative data. I mean, you got all kinds of access here already.
Ripson Paymar, were you going to speak to this point, or do you have a different question?
I was, but I don't have the statute book in front of me anymore, but I still can sort of wing this if I can. I think, Representative Holberg, if I understand this correctly, it's, you know, the purpose of the Fatality Review Board, as has been explained, is to trying to find the institutional gaps in domestic abuse cases where, if someone had information that they could have intervened at the appropriate time, and what that intervention might have been, calling a battered women's advocate, calling the court, whatever it might be. So if I'm reading that correctly, when I see something like a psychologist, a probation officer, or other agent of the court, I'm thinking there's a lot of institutional spots that someone could have intervened. So what they're trying to do is figure out where those gaps are. So if a psychologist, a mental health agency, a domestic abuse program that works with offenders had that information, that they, you know, that they get the appropriate training, et cetera, so these cases don't happen again. So, I mean, I haven't read the statute clearly enough, but that's what I think that's getting at.
And Representative Holberg.
Mr. Chair, if I might maybe provide an example. Access to all this court record, let's just say the victim was divorced 5 years earlier. The ex-husband is nowhere in the picture in this relationship between the victim and the perpetrator, but there was a divorce in which a psychological evaluation was done on the ex, and the victim did a determined custody and parenting and all kinds of things. Maybe kids were interviewed. And none of that data has anything to do with the victim and the perpetrator 5 years later and a fatality. I don't believe that this group should have access to this. It has no bearing on what their mission is. And then when you read the existing law and look at all the latitude they have to very sensitive information directly related to the victim and the perpetrator, they already have a lot of latitude, and I'm trying to figure out what they're not getting now that would justify opening up all of this very private and sometimes identified confidential information that in many instances will not be just about the victim, but about people and their family, et cetera, that may or may not have anything to do with the situation that resulted in the fatality.
Representative Paymar.
Well, Mr. Chair, your hypothesis is that they're going back in history and looking at past husband, past spouses and families. Is that what you're? I mean, I can't imagine that that's what the Fatality Review Board is looking at. Granted, they would get that information, I suspect, if they dug deeper. But you know what they're trying to do is find out what trends helps institutions understand these issues more carefully. I guess I just had a question about whether these fatality review boards are under any authority to maintain confidentiality of the data that they collect. I don't see that. I'm sort of sorry, Representative Holmberg, went off track there, but before I lost the mic, I thought I'd ask the question.
I would note, Representative Paymar and Representative Holmberg, that this is going to Judiciary, and I would think that this question falls squarely within the jurisdiction of Judiciary, so it needs to be fixed between now and then. You don't think so, Representative Holmberg?
Well, Mr. Chair, this is where data issues and access and classifications are determined.
Absolutely. No, I agree. This is where we talk about data matters. However, at the same time, this does come under the basic principle and subject matter of the bill of why they need the information. So, I mean, that's the whole point of why they're doing it. But if you have a motion was of sorts made by Representative Scott, if that is the solution. Do you wish to, we have a 24-hour rule on amendments in this committee. However, I will consider it for the purposes of if you can specifically state the amendment, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes,
and
I would.
Before you do, Representative Holmberg, does Representative Scott's amendment solve your concern?
Well, Mr. Chair, I would be much more comfortable. I believe she's going to move to delete the new language on line 17 would be my guess what her motion is going to be, and I would be very supportive of that and then urge the author that if they can come and carve out some kind of more focused access directly related to victims and perpetrators and not open up the whole family file, I'd be much more comfortable with that type of approach.
Representative Schoen, do you want to be heard on that amendment as stated? Do you understand the amendment as stated? Do you oppose or would you consider it?
I absolutely would consider it. I mean, the reality is that these two lines weren't in the bill before. We want to move forward. I certainly don't want to cause any problems. I know people were up late last night, and you've got other bills to be heard here as well, too. And we do plan to be here next year on a whole other issue. But if Representative Liebling had a comment, I'd certainly take that for under consideration.
Hello. I'll recognize her when the mood strikes me, Representative Schoen. Representative Liebling.
Mr. Chair, I would oppose striking that language. I think that guts the bill, frankly. I mean, doesn't it? Seems to be kind of the heart of the bill. I know you've got this other line relating to 1325, but what I would like to see, I think we're all going to the same place here. And so what I would suggest, we just need some language to either tighten up what's available, I can't do it on the fly here, and I'm not sure it can really be done well on the fly, but to tighten up what's available under 13.84, or to require some kind of showing that it's actually related to the case. I mean, if this was related only to the perpetrator or to the victim, I don't think any of us would really have a problem. But when you're citing this section, really, I think Representative Holmberg is right on. It really potentially brings in a lot of stuff. And when you go into court and, you know, people think that when stuff is private, they think it's private. And if it's really needed and it's handled in a discreet way for a good purpose, fine. But I just think it needs to be narrowed. So I'm not in favor of deleting that language because I think it kind of deletes your bill, frankly. I mean, you're the guy who's going to decide that. But I know Representative Holmberg's concerned. This is the data committee we need to deal with. But I'm comfortable passing it along with your assurance that you're going to tighten the language in a way that and maybe work with Representative Holmberg and try to find some kind of compromise language here that meets the concern that I think is kind of widely shared. I certainly support having the review team be able to continue to work and find, you know, refine this evidence-based process. I think that's a great goal, and if we can do that, you know, we're saving lives, and that's a terrific thing to do, but it does need. We just need to find language that accomplishes it a little better.
I'm going to have Representative Scott state her amendment specifically for the record. Before she does, Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My comment is just a concern that I heard out of Representative Paymar, Paymar's comment when he stated when they review this and there may be institutions or professionals that failed to come forward that could have prevented this. My concern there is with that coming out, could there be charges of negligence or civil lawsuits that would come and stem out of that when someone had the opportunity and the availability to prevent something and failed to act? And that's my concern, and I guess I just wanted to make sure that that's not where we were going.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Paymar.
If I had known, I would have brought the statute, but maybe the witness can answer the question, because I was the author of the Hennepin County Fatality Review Board, so I know a little bit about it. That would not happen, and I don't know if the witness can answer this, but they are under certain confidentiality rules about this data. Otherwise, they would never get it. No one would agree to give this Fatality Review Board this information if they weren't under the same data privacy control. I mean, it's a small, select group of people that looks at this information, and I can tell you that research has shown nationally that these review boards have saved lives. It points to the discrepancies, the gaps in the system, and whether it's a mental health agency or a probation officer, it shines a light on it. It does not become, the particular case does not become public. And I don't have the statute in front of me to show, but I just Thank that's you. All I can say. And I don't know if the witness can clarify any of that. Or
I think that adequately clarified it, Representative Paymar. Representative Scott, would you state your amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would move to delete on line 1.17 after the semicolon the underscored court services data under section 13.84.
Okay. The amendment, the oral amendment from Representative Scott is as stated. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
No. Motion does not prevail. Moving on, other Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Schoen and maybe Representative Holberg and Scott, I think something as simple as adding the words related to the victim or the perpetrator might solve this problem. I know we always run into trouble when we try to draft things on the fly, but on line 1.17, and I don't offer this as an amendment, I offer this for food for thought for the next committee, but after the word, the second word data, insert related to the victim or perpetrator, yeah. And think about whether that language solves your problem going forward.
Okay.
I don't offer it as an amendment. I think you should talk about it in between this committee and the next to make sure I'm not opening a different can of worms for you.
Yeah. Thank you. Representative Schoen, if you can just speak to others between now and the next committee on that.
Mr. Chair, I think that'd be great, and I look forward to working with Representative Holberg and our fantastic judiciary chair as well to move that forward. So,
thank you. Other comments to the bill? Then I renew my motion that House File 838 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Policy. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no.
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 Motion prevails.
Thank you, members.
Thank you, Representative Schoen. Next file, House File 704, Representative Hillstrom, Family Reunification Act of 2013. And if John Choi and Ron Elwood would come forward and be prepared to testify on the bill. Representative Hillstrom moves House File 704 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Policy. Representative Hillstrom, your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Members, this bill has had a very long life of controversy, and we think we've worked out all the controversy. So House File 704 really looks at instances where after a child and parents' relationship, the parental rights, have been terminated, that there may be an opportunity for that parent and child to be reunified. I want to turn this over to County Attorney Choi because he has really taken the lead on working out this compromise, and I think he can speak to why it's needed.
Mr. Choi.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, pleased to be here today. In support of House File 704, I first of all want to thank Representative Hillstrom for agreeing to carry this bill and providing leadership, because I know it means a lot to all of the elected county attorneys in the state of Minnesota. This is important legislation that will create a uniform statutory procedure for reunifying children in foster care with a parent after parental rights have been terminated. And, of course, we would only do that when it's appropriate to do so, when it's in the best interest of the child. And really, this will be for very limited circumstances. In fact, the State Department of Health. We've asked them to, or Human Services, we asked them to look at, to see how many kids would actually fall in this category of all these narrow criteria. And there's only 35 children in the state of Minnesota that would actually meet this criteria. And that's not even thinking about whether or not this would be in the best interest of the child. 12 other states in the nation have a process by which a situation like this could be considered. Unfortunately, in the state of Minnesota, we do not have a process. As Representative Hillstrom talked about, this issue has been around for a long time. County attorneys in the past have not supported this legislation for a number of really important reasons, one of which is when we make the extraordinary decision of terminating parental rights, there are some horrible and unimaginable things that have happened to a child. And so when we take those measures, there are just horrible things that are happening. So that aspect of what has happened, and then, of course, when that happens and we need to establish that permanency for the child, we need to move on. And we need to do everything that we can to get that child adopted, cared for by a loving, caring parent. But unfortunately, in this state, many kids, permanency is never established because they're in the foster care system for their entire childhood. And that is a sad thing. And so from my perspective and from the perspective of the advocates, we believe that there needs to be some recognition of a process by which if the parent, the original parent, has some ability and capability and the financial wherewithal to care for that child, and it is in the best, and the child wishes to be reunified with the parent, that justice and our child protection system is best served by having a process by which we can reunify that relationship. And I think there would be a lot of great things that could come of that. There's not a lot of situations, but for those small number of situations, the good that can come of it, I think, can be huge. And I've had an opportunity to spend a lot of time with some people in this situation. And I, as the Chief Prosecutor in Ramsey County, I really believe that justice is not about saddling someone with respect to a static photograph in time of their darkest moments, but about recognizing that people can, over the course of their lives, change. And if they can, and the child has never been adopted and is still languishing in the foster care system, a ward of the state, that the right thing to do is to bring that family back together if it is the appropriate thing to do. So with that, I would just encourage you to support this bill. This is a compromise that has been worked out by the interested parties, and this is a fragile compromise, but I think we're there if the legislature would agree.
Thank you, Mr. Choi. Questions for Mr. Choi? Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm a co-author in the bill, and I support what you're trying to do here, but I don't see anywhere in the bill of how you get this started. Is there a right of a, does a parent go talk to the county attorney? I mean, I don't see where the word go is on this bill.
Mr. Choi?
And Mr. Chairman and Representative Holberg, thank you for that question. That issue was, I think, deliberately left that way. And the way that we envision it is that people that would have an interest, a parent or a guardian ad litem, would bring this matter to the attention of the county attorney or the social service agency, because a petition cannot be brought unless the social service agency head and the county attorney agree. And if that were the case, then consideration would be made. It was very important for county attorneys to ensure that the decision to not bring a petition could not be appealed because of the administrative burdens that would be put on social service agencies and county attorney's offices. So that was just a part of a compromise. I think another part of this is that we as county attorneys recognize that by doing this, there is responsibility on our part to make sure that, you know, we have some processes or we think through how it is that we would deal with things that would be coming to our attention so that we're not just, you know, arbitrarily just ignoring things, but we should actually have a process by which we would work with the social service agency to determine whether or not this situation merits reunification. And if it does, then the county attorney would then, based upon his or her discretion, bring that petition forward in the interest of doing the right thing and justice.
Representative Holbert.
And Mr. Chair, how would Mr. Choi, how would a parent ever know they have a right to initiate this process, or what the basic standards would be that they would need to meet in order to do this?
Mr. Choi.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holbrook, I think that the right doesn't necessarily, and that's one of the things that we wanted to be very careful about, that the right exists with the county attorney and the social service agency, not with the parent, because we didn't want to create false expectations. Because again, when we take this extraordinary measure of terminating permanently someone's parental rights, the best thing for the child, I believe, is for the parties to start recognizing that that's the new reality. We got to get that child adopted. But at the same time, I do believe that we also should be, if a parent who, let's say, had a horrible moment in their life where they were addicted to drugs, and 5 years down the road, they get their life back together, and they start inquiring. I'm hopeful that this bill will provide some help, hope so that their recovery can be, I guess, incentivized, because that, I think bringing back a parent and their child when it's in the right thing to do is an important thing. So I would suspect that people in the system would be letting the parent know, but also, too, I think as a part of what we do as county attorneys and as social service agencies, we should be identifying these cases as well, because we certainly will know about kids who are in the foster care system, not having been adopted, but maybe having some contact with the parent. And so I think we'll be working on making sure that those situations are identified. But one of the things that we wanted to do is make sure that that right was more with the county attorney and the social service agency, so that we would not be creating this the appeal of the decision. That was very important for county attorneys.
Representative Holbert.
Mr. Chair, I agree with everything that you've said and where the power base lies in this process. I'm just wondering, do they have a right to ask? And where is that? It doesn't seem to be delineated anywhere.
Mr. Choi.
Yes.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holbrook, they do have the right to ask. It's just not delineated in the legislation. And we think it's just inherent that that would happen.
Thank you. Mr. Choi, you've been having that very argument in this committee about various bills coming up. Members, I have two more members on the list. I would note that on Representative Simon's bill, I have 10 testifiers in total, 5 pro and 5 con. There also needs to be time to discuss that bill. At this point, we probably are going to recess and come back after the regent selection in order to give that bill the adequate time it needs to be considered, because it can be controversial. I don't know what the amendment is, but it was controversial. That said, if we could hear from Mr. Elwood, and there are two other members on the list, Representative Howell and Representative Johnson, if you could hold your questions until after Mr. Elwood has testified.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid, and in light of what you just said, I will simply say that we've been working on this legislation for many years. I want to really thank Representative Hillstrom, County Attorney Choi, the chair is a co-author, and Representative Scott's a co-author, and Representative Holbrook, you've been incredibly supportive over the years, and I really want to personally thank you for that. And I'll just simply say that Legal Aid is fully in support of this. We've worked with the county attorney, and we really urge your support.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I really applaud that you're doing something that kind of those folks that go through the rehabilitation process actually gets an opportunity to get their life back together. But my question actually goes to, you know, the county attorney is the person that can bring this forward. Which county attorney, if the person bringing the petition lives in Beltrami County and the children in foster care down in the Twin Cities, who's the right county attorney that brings this forward, and who determines that?
Mr. Choi.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I believe that the bill would lay out that, and I believe it would be the county in which the termination occurred.
Thank you. Representative Howe?
Yes.
I guess I didn't see that. What if you could help me with what line that's on.
Mr. Chair and Representative Howe, there's a regular process by which these cases are reviewed, and they start in a certain court, and that would be the court where this petition would be brought. So it would be the county attorney in with the jurisdiction of the original court where the original case began.
Thank you, Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think you possibly need to clarify that. That way there is a direct the person that wants to bring the appeal knows exactly where they have to come back to, because right now you understand that that's what you want, but I don't think it's laid out anywhere in here where they know a direction on where to go. They might just go to their county attorney and their county attorney. I think it would clarify that. So,
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's in subdivision 6, line 3.3, under venue.
Representative Johnson. Yep.
Mr. Chair, I really like the concept of this, of getting the possibility of getting the children back to their parents. I'm probably one of the few people on this committee that's actually seen both sides of this, myself as being adopted, but also as a police officer actually having to take the child away from the families and take their parental, work on getting their parental rights taken away. And seeing the smiles on those kids' faces 2 weeks later just because of the better atmosphere they've been in. Part of my concern is a little bit of what Representative Howe had. For these kids that sit in language or linger in the adoption process, it can sometimes take years for them to get adopted or possibly not at all. I think it'd be a good to get the issue with the proper court jurisdiction. I think it'd be a proper thing to have the either social service or guardian ad litem program keep in contact with the parent, whether it's on a yearly basis, to monitor them. So if their life change, the county attorney or the guardian litem program or the social service can work on getting the reunification on top of that.
Thank you, Representative Howe. Representative Howe, did you have another? Thank you, Representative Johnson. Representative Howe, did you have another comment?
I did. I have
go
one
ahead,
more
Representative
question.
Howe. Yeah,
thank you, Mr. Chair. What happens in the case of multiple children in a family? That do we do this again and again once they reach 15 years old? So if you got three kids in a family and they're 10, 12, and 15, we have to re-go and look at this every time? I guess that's a question. I'm looking at that family unity, and now we're going to break those folks up that were in a foster care together, and now we're going to break them up one at a time. So,
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Choi?
Representative, the way that the bill has been drafted, it would contemplate, I guess, a piecemeal approach in terms of when the eligibility of a child would be met, then a petition could be brought. Now, I suspect that if the parent has corrected all of those conditions of which the parent-child relationship was terminated and a favorable decision was made to reunify a parent and a child, I would suspect that any subsequent siblings would be pretty much a matter of course, that there wouldn't be much to debate or talk about.
Thank you. Seeing no other comments from members of the committee, Representative Hillstrom renews her motion that House File 704 be recommended pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary Finance and Policy. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Testifiers. Yeah. Representative Simon moves that House File 681 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary Finance and Policy. Representative Simon, to your bill. Members, I would note that I was mistaken. We actually have 5 testifiers in favor and 6 testifiers on the list opposed. There needs to be adequate time for discussion as well as for any potential amendments. Representative Simon, to your bill.
Members, I need your help. And more than me needing your help, there are many child victims of sex abuse by adults that need your help. And so my goal in this hearing, or however long we go, is to get them that help, because right now they are out of luck. The courthouse door is completely shut in their face at age 24. No matter what the circumstances, no matter who covered it up, no matter who was active in hiding, coddling, and comforting the perpetrator, they are out of luck. And the courthouse door in Minnesota is shut in their face at age 24. We all know that sex abuse is a crime of secrecy, that victims do not have the courage to speak out until years later, and this is particularly true when the victim is a child. And a child, we know, lacks the emotional skills to come forward, especially when the perpetrator is a family member or another trusted person who uses powerful forms of manipulation. And it's oftentimes only later in life that the child victim will connect the anguish of the present with the crimes and abuses of the past, and I have seen it. And I wish, in a perverse way, that you could all have sat with the many victims that I've talked to over the years, adults who are really profoundly damaged by what they've gone through, and what makes it worse is the institutions that actively cover it up, shift people around, and negligently cover it up and make these kids' lives hell well into their adulthood. And so, members, I have a series of handouts for you, and I don't want to bury you in paper, but I do want to let you know what this bill is all about legally. And if you look at the cover page, which is just the white page, this is as clear as I can possibly make it. This is the law that's in the current statute right now that we enacted as a legislature in 1989. It's a delayed discovery statute. Basically says that the statute of limitation for kids is 6 years from the time they connect the dots. That's how I put it, from the time they connect the dots. So you may like that, you may not like it. These are the words that are in the statute book right there on the wall right now. In 1996, the Supreme Court took a look at those words, which this legislature passed, and came to the conclusion that those words mean age 24. That's what the Supreme Court said in the Blachowy Act decision. What we said, 6 years of the time when they connect the dots, Supreme Court says, no, that means age 24. Now, I'm not going to relitigate that case. It is what it is. I think it was a terrible travesty and an abuse of the process. But whatever it is, the law in Minnesota now is those words, still in the statute, mean age 24. So at age 24, no matter what the circumstance, who covered it up, who actively aided, helped, and comforted the perpetrators of these horrible crimes, age 24, no justice. Door is slammed shut. No matter what the circumstances, the door is slammed shut. Look at the pink sheet. I'm not going to go over it. This is from yesterday. NPR is only one of the outlets that covered this. And you'll read the article, and you'll read about the culture at this institution of covering up and making excuses and sweeping under the rug. And there are kids who are now well into adulthood who are suffering because of, at least what this article alleges, a pervasive culture. Again, if it's past age 24, you're out of luck. That's it. You are out of luck. You are out of time, and there's no opportunity for anything. If you look at the green and yellow sheets, you can read at your leisure if you think this is just a figment of someone's imagination. Look at the green sheet. By the way, this only came about because of the kinds of bills that I'm proposing today. This is Archbishop Mahoney in Los Angeles, where he says in about, halfway down the first page, the young boy involved is now about 18, so Kevin, this is the person who perpetrated the abuse, should certainly not return for another 2 years, by which time the period for filing lawsuits will have passed. And you might say, well, that's California. We do things differently here in Minnesota. Look at the yellow sheet. And look at the back and the top of the yellow sheet. This is from the 80s. It is my recommendation, given the seriousness of our exposure, that the Archdiocese posture itself in such a way that any publicity will be minimized. And then they say, send the guy to Albuquerque, New Mexico. Again, after age 24, out of luck. That's it. The door slammed in your face. And this bill attempts to remedy that. Now, members, I have listened. I've listened very closely over many years, but particularly this year, to the concerns of groups that I really like and trust, groups that I'm allied with on many issues. And they're concerned about what they perceived in this bill to be sort of never-ending, forever liability, particularly that was not based on fault. What this bill as introduced does, and I'm about to introduce an amendment, what this bill as introduced would do, and I still think this is the right approach, but I need to be a vote counter, is it removes the statute of limitations. What I wanted to do a few years ago was to go back to the world before the Blachowy Act decision, 6 years of within the time you connect the dots. But I'll be brutally candid here, that was confusing to a lot of people. And there were evidentiary questions that came up. And so in consultation with others as part of a broad coalition, including the former Chief Justice of Minnesota, Kathleen Blatz, it was her recommendation, among others, that we just say, do away with the statute of limitations. It's a rare thing to do away with the statute of limitations, but we do it for things like wrongful death and other very, very serious and heinous acts of abuse or crimes. So I've heard, I've listened, I've heard about institutions that are worried about what they call forever liability when it comes to non-fault-based causes of action. And so I will offer the A3 amendment, Mr. Chair, and with your indulgence, I'd like to explain the A3 amendment. Here's what it does.
So explain. Go ahead, Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A3 amendment says, unlike the bill as introduced, which says no statute of limitations, that is totally wiped out, this would only limit that principle to the future. In other words, it only prospectively, from this day forward or from the day of enactment, says that there's no statute of limitations, and it only limits the causes of action that can be pursued on that basis to negligence. So a lot of what you've heard from the opponents, and I suspect what you'll still hear, and hopefully if we put this amendment on, they'll be arguing against a bill that no longer exists. What they're talking about is forever liability that's not even based on fault. And there's a principle in the law called vicarious liability, which means if someone's buying, if someone's driving a Best Buy truck and they do something wrong within the scope of their employment, even the fact that they're an employee of Best Buy means that Best Buy is on the hook for it. It's called vicarious liability. It's not a fault-based legal theory. It just says that that's the way it is, and that's the way our system has been for a while. But I'm willing to make a painful concession and say that we're not going to touch vicarious liability. It's often called respondeat superior for those who like to throw Latin around. So the A3 amendment gets rid of that, does not touch it. You're still age 24 when it comes to that, and I'm willing to concede that. But when it comes to negligence, I am not willing to make a concession. When it comes to stuff like what's in these memos, and I don't care whether it's a religious institution, I'm not trying to pick on any religion generally or specifically. It could be any institution. It could be Penn State. It could be anyone else. When it comes to negligence, the stuff that's in these memos, I will not make any concession. I'd rather go down in flames than make any concession on that issue. So I am conceding completely and totally on vicarious liability. So no more forever liability when it comes to anything that's not fault-based. But for something that is fault-based, like negligence, that, and even then, only going forward, as of, I guess, August 1st would be the presumptive date, would there be negligence. And then this also creates a three-year window. We've done two windows before in Minnesota, 1989 and 1991. It's been 22 years since we've done a window. We would create a three-year window so that otherwise stale claims could be revived, but only for those 3 years. So all the institutions that we know and love and trust, who I'm sure have come to you with their concerns, I have listened to them, and I understand that they want some finality, they and their insurers and others. And they will get it, at least for past incidents, in 3 years. So they will know as of August 1st, 2016, if we pass this bill, they will know what the sum and substance and the total of their exposure is, their insurers will know, and everyone else will know. So I want to give them that finality. So to repeat, totally not touching vicarious liability, which is a non-fault-based legal cause of action. But touching negligence for institutions only as to future for the statute of limitations and creating a three-year window, that's the A3 amendment. And before I get to the testimony, Mr. Chair, with your indulgence, I'd just like to put the amendment on because that's the shape that I'd like the bill in.
Okay.
And we can discuss the new bill, not the bill as it once was.
Thank you. To get the bill in the shape the author so desires, all in favor of the A3 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Simon. Your bill is amended, but you have some testifiers listed. And members, as we know, we're running short on committee time. I'm going to ask testifiers to keep their testimony to 2 minutes. It's my understanding there is an agreement on who will be testifying.
Yes. Mr. Chair, we are going to cut down our testifiers on our side, and we may just only have one. And that it's my pleasure to introduce, I wish it were under different circumstances, Mr. Jim Keenan, who is a victim himself of childhood sex abuse.
Thank you. Mr. Keenan, please introduce yourself for the record and keep your testimony to 2 minutes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hobart.
Thank you. So are you saying that we're only going to have 15 minutes of testimony on this bill and then we're not going to take testimony tonight, or what's your intent?
I don't know how much testimony there will be until I see who testifies, Representative Holberg, but I'm asking testifiers to keep their testimony limited to 2 minutes. Mr. Keenan.
Mr. Chair, excuse me, Mr. Chair and committee, thank you for having me. I'm a survivor of sexual abuse by a Catholic priest. I was abused in the late 70s as an altar boy at Church of the Risen Savior. My understanding, I am about the 34th, the 35th victim of the priest who abused me to come forward. I was born in 1967. My priest who abused me's first victim was 1961, 6 years before I was born. I wasn't even a thought in my dad's head at that point. This priest was moved from diocese to diocese, or parish to parish, in order to cover up his actions. He should have never come across my radar. If he was a worker in any other institution, he would have been taken out of the loop. The church didn't have any reason to take him out of the loop. They realized in things that I've read through my case, they realized they had a limited time to cover it up. And once it was time, it was done. I brought suit to the church in 2003 or 4, somewhere in there, I'm sorry. And we went all the way to the Minnesota State Supreme Court. And my case was dismissed on statute of limitations. I believe that the court system needs to be ready to hear victims when victims are ready to talk. As a 38-year-old man, it was time. I had lived my ups and downs. My wife would tell you that they're blue funks, where I would go into periods of depression and not realize what it was tied to. When you grow up as a survivor of sexual abuse, there's not a lot of people you can talk to. In fact, this morning I made comment to somebody that I have friends, after having seen me on the news last week several times, a little irritated with me that I had never told them. I have a bowling buddy that I've known for 20 years, and he was amazed on Thursday afternoon that I hadn't shared with him that I was a victim of sexual abuse. It's not something you just go around and say, hey, by the way, when I golfed and played racquetball and did everything with the priest that my parents trusted. When your child's hanging out with the priest as an adolescent, a pre-adolescent, that's a good thing, supposedly. But not when he's a pedophile. And not when he's been allowed to go on and on and on. I believe this bill would give onus on institutions who knowingly harbor these people. It would give them pause. It would give them reasons to go, wait a minute, we need to expose this. We need to have this person removed from this situation. I should have never met the priest who abused me. I should have never met him. And I support this bill wholeheartedly, and I believe that you all should too, in good conscience, for safety for kids and protecting our children. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Keenan, for being here and giving that testimony. I understand it's difficult, and for your ability to keep it brief. Members, after this, do you have any other testimony in favor, Representative Simon?
Mr. Chair, you know, we do, but we will suspend it in the interest of time, reserving the right, I suppose, to bring it back as some sort of rebuttal, but hopefully we won't need that.
Understood. Thank you. Is there a member of the public who wishes to be heard in testimony? You're a proponent of the bill, sir? Okay, please take a seat here, and please keep your testimony limited to 2 minutes. No, a seat right here at the table, sir.
Thank you. I'll be very brief. I have not talked to the author. I'm a victim of childhood sexual abuse, but I'm not going to talk about that today. I'd like this material handed off to the member.
The page would approach and hand out his material.
My name is Tom Ho, for the record. I live in St. Paul, Minnesota. I am a victim of childhood sexual abuse. I'm not going to talk to you about that today because Ruben Rosario of the St. Paul Pioneer Press and John Walsh of the Rochester Post Bulletin did articles about me in the past, and that can speak to my personal. I listened to the opponents of the bill testify at Senate hearing last week, and I felt compelled to straighten things out at this hearing today. We heard the whining about having to keep records for 50 or 60 years, but thought at this hearing today. We heard the whining about having to keep records for 50 or 60 years, but you know, in the old days, you used to have to put it on a PsyQuest platter. Today, you can get a scanner, document scanner, everything can be easily documented, and you can put it on a little disk, can be at 1 terabyte, so there shouldn't be any complaint. The insurance company, we hear stories about the expense it will be to insure those who serve kids' needs. I believe that these companies and organizations have been overcharged for many years by the greedy insurance company. The fact is, we don't know what is going on as far as liability insurance, because all these deals and settlements are backroom deals that are kept secret and quiet, and we cannot know. I encourage the legislature to demand facts and find out what is the true fact of the liability insurance. There are states like Kentucky that have no statute of limitation on child sexual abuse, and they are working fine. they have organizations that serves kids. They're not complaining about the insurance or anything. They know how to serve it. The church, the lobbyists from the church will tell you today that they help victims that come forward to them. I will tell you that this is not the truth. My personal experience with Archdiocese of St. Paul was very helpful in the beginning. They had an excellent advocate in Phyllis Warshawn who helped me in so many ways to heal. But once she retired, Father Kevin Dunn replaced her with someone that was totally, he could totally control. We no longer had a victim advocate who was could act independent of the chancery. She was just a yes person for Father Kevin. I soon found myself cut off from all help at the worst possible time. Father Kevin's selfish move helped left me without health insurance and therapists. I also met many others who reached out to the church,
Mr.
Holmes, and were victimized.
If you could wrap up your testimony.
Pardon?
If you could wrap up your testimony, please. Thank you.
Finally, I'd like to say, I know today through organizations like Just Tell that we are changing things. I was honored to be part of a mail panel discussion at Penn State in October, and there was a 15-year-old that was standing there right next to me revealing everything to the world. We are changing the fact that kids will be able to come forward now. There was nothing for me when I was faced with this 40, 50 years ago, and I want you to encourage you to pass this bill as amended, I guess. I would like to see it not be amended, but I will speak for the amendment. We didn't have the help. We didn't have anybody to reach out for. When we did reach out, we were re-victimized.
Mr. Holm, thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate it. Thank you for keeping it brief. Members, Representative Paymar has notified his committee that starts in this room that they will be starting late. So we will go late on this committee, but we will take a vote by 10 o'clock. We will now be taking testimony from opposition. Valerie Doslin, Minnesota Child Care Association. Oh, I'm sorry. Dan Connolly, first one. Please come down and introduce yourself for the record. What happened to this list?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, my name is Dan Connolly. I'm an attorney with Fagry Baker Daniels.
Thank you, Mr. Connolly. Please keep your testimony limited to 2 minutes. Thank you.
I will do my best. Yes, Mr. Chair. And I advise the Minnesota Religious Council. I've been asked to discuss the impact of House File 681. House File 681 would eliminate any statute of limitations for any claim alleging child sexual abuse. We do not oppose eliminating the civil statute of limitation for claims against perpetrators because they presumably know the facts, know what happened. But employers and organizations very rarely know the facts of what actually happened, and discovering those facts becomes increasingly difficult with each passing year. As a practical matter, at some point, allowing these claims 30, 40, 50 years after the alleged abuse leaves these non-actors defenseless, whether they had any actual fault or not. It's precisely because memories fade, records are lost, and the facts are harder and harder to discover that virtually every other civil claim in Minnesota has a statute of limitations, a time by which any lawsuit must be filed. It means defendants will get a fair hearing, and it protects the judicial process from unwarranted claims. This bill, however, would impose forever liability on all these defendants. So, for instance, in the school setting, you could bring a claim any time against a fellow teacher or counselor who the plaintiff claims should have known that abuse was occurring, and at any time against a county or city which did not prevent further abuse after a report was filed, and against an employer. Now, we appreciate Representative Simon's modification of the bill with the A3 amendment regarding vicarious liability, but it only solves the problem after the first 3 years. For the first 3 years, entities would be fully liable without fault for any claims back to their founding, whether they took all the preventive measures, whether they had any fault or not. So it only partially solves the problem.
Thank you, Mr. Connolly. Please wrap up your testimony.
Very well. Finally, other states have considered this very issue. No state has adopted as broad a statute as permitted here. Some states have allowed open windows. As Representative Simon noted, there have been two windows passed in Minnesota in the past, and some states have removed the statute for perpetrators. We support this. Some states have allowed claims after longer periods of time based on a higher showing. We support this as well. In fact, in 2008 in front of this committee, we supported a bill which would have raised the age to 35, removed vicarious liability, and did not have an open window provision, that three-year provision. We still support that bill today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Connolly. Mr. Tom Grunhofer, League of Minnesota Cities, please take a seat.
Mr. Chair, while he's coming up, I just want to voice my strong disappointment that the time necessary to discuss a very important, very emotional issue with an amendment that was just put on is going to be limited to a half an hour. This issue deserves the ability for everybody to speak, not be cut off, and I can't believe that this can't be laid over to another meeting or come back or whatever, but to try and do this in a half hour's time does not provide this very important issue the time that it deserves.
Understood, Representative Holbrook. Thank you. Mr. Grunhofer, please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Grunhofer, legal counsel for the League of Minnesota Cities. I want to stay at the front. We have not adopted a formal position either for or against this bill as of yet, but we do have concerns with the forever liability issues that have been talked about extensively. I do want to again thank Representative Simon for his accommodation on the A13 amendment, but we are particularly concerned about the three-year ongoing window from this day. We're concerned about the fact that for claims that might be made that are 40 or 50 years old, that frankly most of our local governments will not have the resources, the evidence, or the people in place to adequately respond to really some of those very old claims. But again, I want to thank Representative Simon for the A3 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Grunhofer. Mr. Karen Beckelman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Karen Bockelman. I'm a retired pastor in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, and I am chair of the Minnesota Religious Council. We are concerned that the proposed elimination of any statute of limitations applies not just to perpetrators of abuse, who certainly ought to be held accountable for their actions, but to congregations and other church organizations accused of negligence. Thus, in this three-year window, a congregation could face liability decades after the perpetrator of the abuse was dead. These old claims can be very difficult to defend. As you have heard, records are lost, memories fade, witnesses may have moved or died. But of most concern to us is that the costs of investigation and defense in both time and money put at risk the resources we have devoted to prevention work over the last three decades. Since the late 1980s, our churches have worked very hard to develop resources, policies, and procedures for the identification of abusers, assistance for victims, their families, and communities. We are committed to zero tolerance and have formal written standards of conduct, discipline, and policy that are publicly available. We comply with laws regarding background checks and mandatory reporting, and in fact go beyond the requirements of those laws. We work to make our churches places of safety by training our leaders and members to recognize the warning signs of abuse, both in those who have been or are being abused and in the behavior of abusers. We establish and publicize procedures for reporting suspected abuse to the authorities and to those within the church who can act to remove abusers from positions of trust and to help victims find the resources they need to begin healing. For over three decades, we have worked to create faith communities where caring adults know how to respond to what they see and hear. The earlier the abuse is reported, the more quickly the allegation can be investigated, the perpetrator identified and removed from a position of trust, and victims given resources for healing, thus further abuse being prevented. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Beckelman. Grace Schwab.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Grace Kelleher with the Minnesota School Boards Association. I appreciate you hearing testimony on this. I want to start out by thanking Representative Simon. This is major movement on an issue that's very troubling. I just want to leave you with some clear facts about why schools are different than some of the other folks you hear up here. First of all, costs are, if in fact the schools have a judgment in that three-year window or later, that is spread across something we call the judgment levy. So anything that is levied by the courts, we can spread across to the taxpayers going forward. So for this three-year window, if there should be cases against school districts from the from the 50s and 60s, and a judgment found, we'd spread it across that levy in order to pay that judgment. Things that would not be covered. Every district, if challenged this way, would feel the need to do an investigation, find the records, hire an attorney, get some advice. And those costs are not covered anyway. They would have to come out of our general education budget. And last but not least, we've got concerns about insurance coverage going forward. Unlike cities that can sort of pass that on, school districts cannot levy for insurance. That, again, comes right out of the classrooms going forward. So this is an issue that we've been passionate about as an association. The last time Representative Simon brought this forward in 2007, we worked on making tougher background checks, and we worked on making sure that any teacher that's charged with a felony is immediately suspended. So it's our commitment to eradicate this from the public schools across Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the time.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Kelleher. Valerie Doslin, please take the seat and introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Doslin, and I represent the Minnesota Child Care Association. The Minnesota Child Care Association is made up of members of licensed child care centers throughout Minnesota. I first of all want to thank Representative Simon for the amendment that he offered. I'm not an attorney. I don't like having to come to civil law committee. I'm still trying to digest what this amendment means for my clients. I think, still have concerns about the open window portion. I think the amendment goes a long way on future claims, but just have continue to have questions about the open window and want to assure that if claims are made against licensed child care centers, that they are able to defend them adequately defend themselves. And I will continue to digest the amendment. And again, thank you to Representative Simon.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Doslin. Bob McCollum.
Mr. Chairperson, thank you for allowing me to speak this morning. I'll try to be very brief. I'm a member of the MBLA.
Mr. McCollum, please introduce yourself for the record.
Yes, Robert McCollum.
Thank you.
I'm a member of the Minnesota Defense Lawyers Association, but I also serve on a board of a nonprofit. I've represented nonprofits in the past. I'm not here specifically on behalf of nonprofits. I have concerns about this bill for a couple of reasons. First of all, it'll create the situation, and I've been involved in this situation before in my practice, where we've had to defend claims that go back literally for years and years and years after somebody has passed away, where there's no evidence from which you can defend that claim, and the claim is made by an individual who may or may not have a valid claim. There are reasons why we have statutes of limitations. They're designed to create a balance between the rights of individuals who have been injured and the rights of those against whom those claims are made, whether those claims are right or wrong. Secondly, from a practical standpoint, if you think that these claims now, if they're going to be brought now and they relate to incidents that happened 25 or 30 years ago, are going to be covered by insurance, you may be dead wrong on that. If that's what you think, then you shouldn't vote on this bill. The problem is that what insurance coverage applies and may apply is what's called occurrence-based coverage. Those coverages will apply at the point in time at which the incident occurs and damage occurs during the policy period. So if you are sued now, if you're a nonprofit organization, if you are an association, if you are a boys club, if you are a group of coaches, you are a school district, if you cannot find your policies of insurance, which may or may not apply, you will bear the burden of the cost of defending these claims. And the cost of defending these claims can be substantial. You have to pay for an attorney. You have to pay for that the attorney's associate, the paralegal, the court costs, the expert witness fees. And it's a daunting thing for many organizations and for nonprofits, small organizations, associations. It can literally put them out of business. You will be I hope you understand that you may be creating another class of victims here because of the issues that are before you now. I just think that, and I want to appreciate it to Representative Simon for the amendment to the bill that he's brought before you. We will take a look at that amendment, and I thank you for the opportunity to speak with respect to the bill.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. McCollum. Questions from members of the committee? Members, we have about 10 minutes to discuss the bill. If folks have questions about it between now and judiciary, now is the time to do it. Representative Liebling. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Scott was on the list first. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since we do have a little bit of time left, I don't know if there are any other victims that came here to testify that were with Representative Simon, but I just feel like they need to have their voices heard if they came down here to and be brave enough to testify. I don't know if you'd allow that or not.
Were there any other victims that needed to be heard, Representative Simon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, thank you. I appreciate that gesture. There were none that I have been working with in terms of testimony, but as you saw with the gentleman who I'd never met who came up, there may be others who on their own have come. I just don't know.
Okay. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. There's no question that this is such a very difficult issue, and appreciate that Representative Simon is trying to bring forward the rights of people who've been abused. And there is no question that has been, society didn't deal with that well, and we're only now beginning really to come to grips with that and the harm it can cause. The concern that I have about this bill is really not about the institutions so much, but it's really about the fact that and I don't think any of the testifiers really addressed this, maybe the last gentleman a little bit, but these, when somebody can file a lawsuit alleging that conduct happened, and sometimes those are filed against people who in fact didn't commit the conduct. And I realize that it, on the one side, it takes a lot for a victim to come forward, but there are cases in which people come forward where it didn't happen. And these are issues that are dealt with in the course of a case. Sometimes people are found to be liable and sometimes they're not. But the problem is when you remove a statute of limitations, there's a possibility for people to come forward many years after they're alleging something happened. And you have the ability then to make an allegation in public against somebody who, if we just look for a second, and imagine a case where somebody, in fact, didn't commit the abuse. You're opening them up to being accused forever. And let's just say that could be any of us, right? Any of us could, somebody could come to me and say, 30 years ago, Tina Liebling did X to me. And the moment that person made that allegation, my reputation would be ruined, whether I did, even, you know, not having done anything, my reputation would be ruined. And we know that these are allegations, that once that allegation is made, it is really a life-changing thing for people. And it can be, there is such a thing as created memory. And memory, as we know, is not something that's like recording a photograph. Memories are made of a lot of different things. And this is science is beginning to reveal this more and more. I am in no way suggesting that the people who are coming forward and saying I was a victim are made that up or anything of that kind. I utterly believe that the problem is probably more on the side that people who were victimized have not come forward more than on the other side. But it does happen on the other side, and that means an innocent person can have their life ruined by that allegation. Statutes of limitations are meant to try to strike a balance, as this gentleman said, between people who have a legitimate beef and someone who may or may not have actually been the cause of that. And it does disturb me that we would remove that statute of limitations forever for individuals, that they would have to defend against this. The longer it goes, the harder it is going to be, and the more invitation there is for people to come forward for some other reason. They're angry about something else. They don't like the person. I, you know, there are a lot of most people are rational, reasonable people, but there are people who are not, and these things do happen, and that's the concern that I have. And I do appreciate that you've tightened up the bill, Representative Simon. I think some of what you've done makes it better for certain things, but I don't think it's addressed that concern that I have. And I don't know if there are any testifiers to address that, but I just think the people who are not perpetrators, who may be accused, I don't hear anybody speaking for them.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and those are all thoughtful and important issues to discuss. I would say, and this doesn't get to the kind of intellectual heart of what you're saying, all the stakeholders here, as I understand it, and they can correct me if I'm wrong, the Religious Council and others, they actually agree that as to the individuals, they have no objection. I know you do, but I'm just letting members know. I mean, there's no one here lobbying on behalf of, frankly, the perpetrators. So everyone's willing to say that the individual perpetrator, I'm just telling you, that doesn't allay your concern or address it intellectually at all. But let me try to do that now. Time, the passage of time, is the enemy, not the friend, of the plaintiff in these situations. I understand the concern, and it's one that we all might have. Oh my gosh, from a defendant's posture, we don't have the records, the people are dead, the witnesses are gone, they've moved. That doesn't help a plaintiff. That hurts a plaintiff. As anyone who's ever tried or been a part of a civil lawsuit knows, especially, there are a lot of factors involved, that doesn't make it easier for the plaintiff. That makes it a lot tougher. This idea that somehow the absence of records or and people's deaths makes it a slam dunk for someone to come out and say, this happened to me, and by the way, there are no records to substantiate what I did, no one else who is around anymore who can corroborate that I told them such and such from an evidentiary standpoint. This idea that passage of time allows, you know, dishonest people, I'm not saying you're making that argument, but it's, I'm sure, popped up in our heads, allows dishonest people to seize on innocent and wrongly accused victims and succeed in court. That is just not true. Now, let me try to be intellectually honest as to your concern, Representative Liebling. Is it possible that someone, after the passage of time, could come and knowingly wrongly accuse someone? Yes. I would be intellectually dishonest to say that that's not possible. It is possible. I will say that at the unveiling of this bill, there was a press conference held, and someone came out and named a name of a teacher at Breck School. So I guess my point is, they can still make the accusation without filing a lawsuit, and they do. Someone did at this press conference. They said, I was abused by, I can't remember the person's name, at Breck School, as were 20 others. You might have seen the Star Tribune coverage. So people are free to make allegations anyway. And to your point, possibly, I suppose, ruin someone's reputation. So I would be dishonest to tell you that that isn't possible. But I will tell you, there's a New York Times article from a few years ago in which Patrick Schultz, who was a former colleague of Mr. Connolly's, who is now on the federal bench appointed by George W. Bush for the District of Minnesota. He's a federal judge, very distinguished, very respected. And he, like Mr. Connolly, throughout much of his career, did a lot of defense work in this area. And he was asked by the New York Times, now that he's not doing it anymore, it wasn't attorney-client privilege, he was asked, well, how many of the hundreds and hundreds of cases do you suspect were actually innocently accused people? He said it was in the single digits out of many hundreds. I think maybe it was even thousands. So is it possible? Yes, it is possible. I will concede that point. Is it likely? I would say no. And the likelihood of success after such an accusation, particularly the passage of time, is so de minimis and so small that I would say, to me anyway, personally, my values say that the balance weighs in favor of doing this and not. You make a perfectly intellectually legitimate argument, and I want to address it as such. But I think it's important to weigh the balance here. And I think there's a sense that the balance is on one side.
Mr. Chair,
thank you, Representative
Simon.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much, Representative Simon. I'm really struck and kind of overwhelmed by the magnitude and importance of this piece of legislation. Clearly, we don't have enough time. It's 1 minute to 10 o'clock, and I just completely echo Representative Holberg's concern that this just has not been fully considered. After having listened to Representative Liebling's remarks, I am really, really struck by what an important piece of just consideration that is. And I heard what you had to say, Representative Simon, about that you spoke for the stakeholders, that they have, in fact, you know, they support this. I would be very interested, and we don't have time now, to hear from some of the stakeholders who are here who are opposed to the bill for the reasons that they stated, how they feel about what they think about what Representative Liebling had to say. I would be very interested to know how they feel about that. And again, we don't have time.
Representative Pugh, did you have a specific question for a specific testifier in light of something they said?
I am just very interested in hearing. I don't have a specific question. If all of those testifiers are here and if they heard and are thinking about what Representative Liebling has challenged, I would like to hear from them. And again, we don't have time.
Okay. Thank you. Other members of the committee, Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just Representative Simon, I checked your Senate companion has got second reading. So we're not in a big rush to meet a deadline here. I don't know what your thoughts are as far as if you're willing to lay this over and let people keep working on it. If you're not open to any additional changes, is this your bill? And come hell or high water, this is how it's going to go to the floor. I'd just be curious to your thoughts on
Representative
that.
Simon.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, no, I'm always open, and I've told some of the folks you've heard and others who have not testified, I am always open to another suggestion, another possible outcome. I will meet with people. I will take phone calls at home on the weekend. I will do whatever. That's not to say I might agree with them, but I will take those phone calls. In terms of today, we do have other committee stops, and I am really hesitant to lay it over today, but I am absolutely willing to work with anyone and everyone on language that they think is more reasonable, and I will take calls at all hours of the day and night, whether we're here or not.
Thank you, Representative Simon. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I need to clarify. Representative Simon said something about nobody's defending the perpetrators. I want to make it really clear. I'm not defending any perpetrator.
Right.
I'm thinking of the people who may not be perpetrators,
yes,
who might get caught up in this. So I just want to clarify that before we take any vote.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative Johnson, did you have briefly, please?
I can wait. I'll be hearing this bill in other committees.
Okay. Thank you. Then Representative Simon renews the motion. The House File 681 be recommended to pass as amended to be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary Finance and Policy. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes. Thank you, members. Committee is adjourned.